The Academy of American Poets was established in New York in 1934 by a woman named Marie Bullock. Its purpose was then, and is now, to stimulate and to foster the production and the presence of poetry in this country. I'm Susan McGinnis, your host for KUAC's Conversations. Today, we sit down to talk with William Wadsworth, the executive director of the Academy of American Poets. For the last year, he has overseen the administration of the Academy's 5 major annual awards and fellowships, the lectures and the readings done for the Academy by this country's poets, and in a departure from its 56-year history, he took the Academy of American Poets out of New York for the first time last year to the Southwest. This year, he has ventured out again to help sponsor and take part in the Alaska Poetry Festival, a 3-city celebration of Alaska's poets, poetry, and culture. I hope you'll join me in welcoming Bill Wadsworth to Conversations. Bill, you said that in bringing the Academy out of New York, that one of the things you wanted to do was to expand the geographic reach, poet to poet, poet to audience, and region to region. What's your hope, and what do you think will happen for these ventures?
Well, I would hope, first of all, that the Academy as an organization, which defines itself as a national service organization for poets, would better be able to fulfill its own role in serving poets everywhere in the country. I think our awards and prizes do this already, but the public programs, though we have in fact in the past done a few programs outside of New York, have never on any regular basis, any programmatic basis, tried to create circuits or interchanges or just programs in different regions of the United States and to connect those in some organized way with what we do in New York. If this could in some way really help the wider poetry community in some way instigate some beneficial change, that would be terrific. I would like to think the Academy already performs a great service, but I'm just trying to improve that service.
Mm-hmm. Was this serendipity, or has it been part of a plan to move across the bridges, as it were?
Well, it's a very conscious plan. I would say that in the past 10 years, there have been 2 general trends in the arts that bear upon this particular program. One, I think, is that there has been less support from the federal government for the arts in general, and the great initiative in public funding of the arts that began in the 60s began to be discouraged, really, very explicitly by the Reagan administration. So in that sense, I suppose all arts organizations are struggling to survive and to keep a high profile in the country. But also, separately, there's been a stronger interest in equally representing all areas of the country, and this is most noticeable at the federal level with the National Endowment for the Arts. Several years ago, they made it more a priority in their funding to serve regions that were not major or large cultural centers, usually on the East Coast. And I think this is a good thing. But it also was a signal, I think, to organizations based on the East Coast that they had to respond. And we received that signal from the NEA. They had before, I suppose, supported our programs with unqualified support. But several years ago, the panels voiced a criticism that they felt that our public programs should reach a wider audience. And so I think credit needs to be given to the NEA panels for sending that signal, and we've tried to respond to it in as creative and ambitious a way as we can.
Before we return to the regions that the Academy is now hoping to reach, give people who will not know a snapshot of what the Academy of American Poets does. I've said the purpose is to stimulate and foster the production of poetry in the United States. Can you expand on that, let people know what you do and why?
Well, I'll try to be brief, but I think I'll begin at the beginning. When the Academy was founded in the 30s, 30 years before there was a National Endowment for the Arts, there was very little organized patronage, at least of poetry. And Marie Bullock, who founded the Academy, was raised in France and moved to the United States as an adult, was someone very interested in poetry and was actually shocked by the way poets were treated in this country, or not treated, were ignored. And in her mind, those were poets like Robert Frost and Robinson Jeffers, who were well along in their careers, but were not given the sort of support that we've become used to now for recognized artists. So she founded the Academy, first of all, to give a fellowship, a major fellowship, which was then $5,000, now it's $20,000, to an individual poet who has achieved a lot over a long career. But then other programs followed, including book awards, including college prizes at, I think, 174 universities across the country now, in the effort to support poetry at all levels, not just the most accomplished poets, but poets who are publishing their first book. Our Walt Whitman Prize is an open contest for unpublished poets with a book-length manuscript. College prizes and other sorts of prizes and awards that would be too lengthy to list here. We are a membership organization, and anyone who would like to support the Academy of American Poets and would like to receive our prize-winning books and our monthly newsletter can call or write the Academy, and anyone can join. They don't have to be practicing, much less published poets, to become members. The prizes were the first way. Then in the early 60s, the Academy began to, on an organized basis, sponsor poetry readings at the Guggenheim Museum in New York. And we were one of the first organizations to do so. Now I think there are at least 40 organizations giving poetry readings on a regular basis in New York City. One of the, almost more than reading books of poetry, it's become a very popular way of appreciating poetry.
And do you think the Academy made the ground fertile for the others who have come along?
Oh, I know that we did. The director back then was a woman named Betty Cray, and she was kind of a Johnny Appleseed of poetry in New York in those years. She started the Poets in the Schools program a few years later, which is now almost immediately became a national program. Great initiatives were being taken during that time, which was a great time, I think, for general interest in the arts and support. And the Academy, because it was already in place, was leading other organizations in that direction. Now we have the companionship of many organizations.
We're talking today with Bill Wadsworth. Bill is the executive director of the Academy of American Poets, based in New York City. It has been around since 1934. Bill Wadsworth graduated from the University of Wisconsin at Madison in 1972, a Bachelor of Arts with honors in English literature and philosophy. And from Columbia University, he took his Master's of Fine Arts in Poetry in 1987. You are here to help sponsor, be in support of, and participate in the Alaska Poets Festival. It has been a three-city celebration. The six participating poets are Christiane Balk, Nora Downhauer, Robert Davis, John Haynes, John Morgan, and Tom Sexton. a major theme of this festival and of the seminars that have accompanied it have been poetry and place, the community and the ecology as they relate to poetry, and poets as they relate to place. After listening to these poets, what's your sense of their relationship to place? Is that something I can ask you after so brief an immersion?
Well, it would be hard to generalize because they're six very different poets.
Very true.
John Haynes moved to Alaska to homestead in 1947. Christiane Balk just lived here for a few years. Robert Davis and Nora Downauer are native Alaskan poets and have a very different relationship. What was interesting was to hear each of the poets affirm the importance of place to their poetry, but in very different terms. And I'm sure if you looked at the poems of each poet, you'd find very different styles, very different ways of translating that experience. So I don't think it's anything that can be generalized upon. On the other hand, I think that the relationship between poetry and place, and actually poetry and the natural environment, is a fundamental, even universal, part of poetry. And what's interesting is to see how differently it gets reflected and how well that relationship is articulated by each poet. And they could be poets in New York as well as Alaska.
So one of the reasons I was asking was to see if in your mind it was similar or different.
Well, John Haynes, there's a lot to be said here, and I will try to select from the many thoughts that provokes, but John Haynes said something very interesting yesterday, which was that he mistrusts poets who speak of writing poetry as an expression of their self. And he said that bespeaks a kind of easy certainty as to what the self is. And he said that he's not at all sure the self even exists. And I may be misinterpreting him, but I think, especially in relationship to place, he might be saying that we are what we eat, really. Mm-hmm. We are where we live.
What we do, where we walk.
Right.
What we see.
And so New York poets would be very different in that regard from Alaskan poets, but also different from each other. And I think certainly as in New York, it's hard not to be overwhelmed by place. I think the struggle in New York is often to find your own territory, your own ground within that space. Which leads me to one more thing, maybe, which occurs to me. The poet W.H. Auden, in a very interesting essay called The Prolific and the Devourer, in which he describes poets as prolifics, people who generate and create things, as opposed to the devourers, whoever they may be, who just consume things. And he talks about three basic different types of people. He describes them as scientists, politicians, and artists. And I won't run through the whole essay, but at the end he says something that always has struck me as just wonderful. He says that when we eat, we're all scientists. And when we're at cocktail parties, we're all politicians. And when we're alone, we're all artists. And the place for the poet in my mind is the place the poet's mind goes to when the poet is alone. And it may be a place they haven't seen for very many years. New York poets have those places just as well as Alaskan poets.
Mm-hmm. Robert Davis, another one of the poets in the Alaska Poetry Festival series, offered us this anecdote in one of the same conversations to which John Haynes was responding. He said he had been on an airplane and opened up the Airplane magazine, in which there was advertised an Alaskan place to visit. And the magazine advertisement referred to it as the Great Escape. Robert said, as a Tlingit Alaskan, he found this very distressing, because the natural world, his place, is the place from which he draws all life. I also recalled in this same context a conversation with someone who had just met someone who lived in the bush, and in commenting said, "But isn't that escapism?" I was taken by this comparison. What's your thinking about this kind of dual way of looking at the natural world in 1990?
Well, it's a complex issue. I grew up around New York, but I lived in Vermont for many, many years full-time, and Vermont is not Alaska, but it is a very beautiful rural and, in small places, wilderness environment, relatively unspoiled, maybe even more beset than Alaska by tourists, people escaping from the city. And I understand, I don't think as profoundly as Robert does, but I understand, I think, what he's saying, that this is a kind of perversion. But we live in a, I think, from the point of view of poets anyway, a perverse society. The things that we do for business, for popular entertainment, the ways that we live, don't seem natural. And I think you could ask, you could do a poll of people in New York City, and most of them would agree with you that their life there is unnatural, and that the level of stress, the pace of life, the degradation of the environment, etc., is obvious. And in that sense, they are living perverse lives because they're there. And I think our society is a place where almost everyone is aware that something is missing or something is wrong with their life in some general, maybe very philosophical way. I'm not saying that everything about contemporary life or our society is bad. But one of the things that art exists for, and poetry in particular, is to remind people or bring people back to values, experiences, realities that are eternal and pre-existed the sort of society that we live in now. This is a slightly long-winded answer, I'm sorry, but in defense of the people who are escaping, I would say that they're calling a spade a spade. If you let an animal out of a cage in a zoo, it's escaping. You could also say it's returning to its native ground. And in a sense, I think the people who are escaping, even if they don't know it, are doing that. That is what is drawing them to those places. They're trying to get back to something they understand on a deeper level, on a more unconscious level, better than the lives that they lead in the city. But for them to say they're returning to their native ground, I think might even be more upsetting to Robert, because it would be sentimental. It wouldn't really be true. They're escaping. I guess that would be the only way I could reply to that question.
We're talking once again. If you've tuned in late, you have tuned into Conversations on KUAC-FM. I'm your host, Susan McGinnis, and we are talking today with Bill Wadsworth. Bill is the executive director of the Academy of American Poets. You quoted from Robert Graves in your introduction of the poets at the symposium, and I wonder, you do have it with you. Mm-hmm. Good. Can you read that again? He talks also about the importance of what he views as the natural world in poetry.
Well, this bears upon what we were just talking about, mm-hmm. and it's a very radical and, I think, clear, strong statement of a particular argument for poetry. Quote from, this is from the preface of his book, The White Goddess. This was written in 1945 from the point of view of a European. What is the use or function of poetry nowadays? This was once a warning to man that he must keep in harmony with the family of living creatures among which he was born, by obedience to the wishes of the lady of the house. It is now a reminder that he has disregarded the warning, turned the house upside down by capricious experiments in philosophy, science, and industry, and brought ruin on himself and his family. Nowadays is a civilization in which the prime emblems of poetry are dishonored, in which serpent, lion, and eagle belong to the circus tent, ox, salmon, and boar to the cannery, racehorse and greyhound to the betting ring, and the sacred grove to the sawmill, in which money will buy almost anything but truth, and almost anyone but the truth-possessed poet.
He says a bit earlier in that passage, which is from, for those who find it familiar, it is from The White Goddess, A Historical Grammar of the Poetic Myth by Robert Graves. He says earlier, the function of poetry is religious invocation of the muse. Its use is the experience of mixed exaltation and horror that her presence excites. And then he goes on to say, but nowadays, function and use remain the same, only the application has changed. Do you agree with Robert Graves?
Well, that, I think, would be difficult to answer in depth. Graves was a brilliant and very eccentric thinker. And he constructed what was really an alternative religion. And this religion is described in detail in this book with astounding scholarship. And it's a very interesting book for its scholarship. Whether or not one swallows the religion whole is a whole other question. And as to what he means by religious invocation of the muse, that's we could take a course on that. But the reason I selected this passage to read is because it seems to me here he touches on something that most poets would agree with. Poetry is the most, at least one of the most ancient arts. It is possibly the most ancient use of language, because it's an art form that uses language and uses language in the most, at once the most primitive and the most sophisticated ways. It's an art form that contains really all of human history. And the degree to which we ignore poetry now may be the degree to which we ignore our own history, which is something I maybe would say a little bit more on. But because it's ancient, it dates back to a time when man's connection to nature was unmediated by industry and what we think of as civilization. It was a direct relationship. Men depended upon nature. Religion really was nature worship. And poetry articulated that. That was its first function. And that function, that essential function, remains. We may have found other uses for poetry, but that remains as the core. And one thing that was interesting in hearing poets, native Alaskan poets, read is their very strong sense of this. They didn't have to learn this in school. And when Nora Dauenhauer and Robert, in collaboration, gave us some Tlingit oratory, it was no different to me. Well, I've never heard ancient Greek poetry from ancient Greeks, but it reminded me of ancient Greek poetry. And I think it's true that that ancient poetry is was a universal thing, took different forms. And more ancient cultures like Native American culture retain a simple awareness of that, a direct awareness of that. We have to get back to it through more elaborate means. Even the ancient Greeks and Romans with their pastoral traditions in poetry were already beginning to make it more artificial and sentimental and less immediate, less religious, more arty.
Mm-hmm. But it cuts through in your mind to find what is the essential truth about the human being as an art form. Poetry does this. Is that?
Not as a message. Though there's a great deal of direct wisdom, I think, in most great poetry. But it goes... It includes the unconscious mind.
Mm-hmm.
Often I think mediocre poetry is so concerned with articulating a conscious message that it leaves out the more mysterious and unconscious aspects of the human spirit, the human experience. But I do think that poetry is... I'll give you another quote from T.S. Eliot, which is, "Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information?" We live in a culture that's addicted to information. What poetry gives us is a way back to wisdom.
And is that the role of the poet in America today?
I think it's the role of the poet in every society.
At any time.
At any time. It's a question of how responsive the society is to that wisdom.
That's my next question. What do you think of this country relative to the role of the poet? What do we think of poetry in this country? What's our relationship to it?
Well, first of all, there is a thriving culture of poets and of poetry in this country. There are hundreds of small presses and literary magazines. There are thousands of poets. Most universities now have creative writing programs, which wasn't true 20 or 30 years ago. Living contemporary poets have been accepted into academia in a way that they never were when Robert Frost and T.S. Eliot were in their heyday. We are in many ways a very generous and supportive society when it comes to poetry. But one poet many years ago, sort of looking ahead to all this, wrote that he feared that American poetry would become a hothouse plant, that we build these greenhouses, say, in universities where we nurture poetry, but that it's become a species of organism that won't exist outside the greenhouse, can't survive. And there's some truth to that. And I think... The reason for that is complex, multifaceted, but one reason is that the great virtue of poetry is that it's an art form that can be practiced without even a pen and a piece of paper, without even books. Most of the devices we think of as now as being artificial or ornamental in poetry, like meter, rhyme, alliteration, all the various figures of speech, were very possibly devices purely for memorization. And poems were whole libraries. They were whole encyclopedias in the old days because there was no written language. It was where knowledge or wisdom was contained. Then we acquired books and pens, and now we have PCs. We also have, books for one thing made novels possible. We could start writing prose. We have many other art forms that depend upon instruments of one sort or another, canvas, brushes, pianos or guitars or drums. And now we have art forms that depend upon electric guitars or cameras or
Synthesizers,
all the movie technology. We're building up to art forms that are wonderful forms, but they're very dependent upon the technology that makes them possible, either in a secondary way, recording the song, or in a primary way, taking the picture, making the movie. And along with that, in a technological society, we have telephones, we have automobiles, we have just amazing amounts of paraphernalia to keep us distracted and keep us busy. And they do so to the point that we've become, in many ways, they're slaves of these things. And that doesn't leave a lot of time for poetry. It also doesn't leave much necessity for poetry. But if you go to a society where all the toys, all the instruments have been taken away, what are you left with? What form of entertainment, for that matter, are you left with?
Well, I'm reminded immediately of Nora Dauenhauer at the at her poetry reading, who you've already mentioned chose to read with Robert Davis, a Tlingit oratory, which is what you're talking about. It was an invocation of the spirits to comfort those who are grieving, and it was one long remembered poem by an elder, which had never been written until Nora and her husband went to find the elders and to write it down.
Well, that's another aspect, in the sense that I think there is still no art form that can console us the way poetry does.
Right.
And the Bible, for all the many things it is to many people, is to everyone poetry. Poetry's first and deepest function for people is consolation. But it also is entertainment. It's pleasure. And when you don't have any toys, you can still tell stories. You can still sing. And that's what poetry is in the beginning. And if you go to societies that are poorer than we are, and more ancient, I would say, this may be a controversial statement, but I would say that our relationship to technology is what the European relationship to civilization is. That we've more or less replaced civilization, the European notion of civilization, with our own regard for technology. And in that sense, Europeans are more primitive than we are. They're more primitive people. And consequently, they have more of a connection to poetry.
But primitive, you mean primal in that way?
I don't mean that in any way that's meant to be condescending.
Right.
I mean it as more ancient,
mm-hmm.
more primary. But if you go to even more, let's say, societies that are a little less well-off, if you go to Russia or Eastern Europe, where there's a tremendous popular response to poetry, it's because they don't have as easy access to the toys. And if you go to even poorer societies, if you go to Nicaragua, there's a saying there that you're either a son of a poet or a son of a bitch. Nicaragua is a society where poetry is the popular art form. Everyone writes poetry. Everyone celebrates poetry, either as a written thing or as an oral thing. And I think we're very wrong when we sentimentalize those societies and say it's because of political oppression. Poetry isn't important to them just as a political protest. It's important to them because they have less to go to for the things that art provides. And I may be making an argument for the obsolescence of poetry in our society in that sense. I have a hard time finding time to read. I go to the movies. I have a camera. I talk on the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
But I still find that poetry, as I said, in the end, it's the most synthetic, in the sense of bringing many things together, way of speaking. It's the most consoling way of speaking. It's the the most valuable use of a small amount of time to me is to read a good poem.
Go back to what you said a moment ago. You said, poets connecting us to our history. And you said there's more to be said about that.
I guess what I would say on that count further is that poetry has to do with memory. And the Czechoslovakian writer Milan Kundera has invented the phrase, the culture of the society of forgetting, of organized forgetting. The brevity of our attention spans is a widely recognized fact in this country. And what poetry does is it trains memory, and it requires memory. And when I studied with a European poet at Columbia, he was the only poet of the teachers on the faculty that thought the main reason for having a course in poetry was simply to memorize. And we memorized, in a semester, 1,500 lines of poetry. History is the way that we choose to remember as a society. And I think poetry asserts the importance of that. One other thing I would, just going back to the issue of place that may connect with this somehow, I would like to say is that because we don't live in a primitive, primary society, and neither do Nora Downow or Robert Davis, I think, going back to the quote from Graves, he said that poetry was once a warning that we might screw up. It's now a reminder that we have. And in that sense, it's a protest. And Eastern European poets, some who... I'm thinking of Czesław Miłosz, the Polish poet who won the Nobel Prize in 1980, and has lived in the United States for a long time as an exile, has said that he's not special in being an exile, that all poets are exiles. And I think that even Robert Davis has the sense, when he's in his hometown of Cake, that he's an exile from that original relationship, that original society he would like to celebrate. This might lead into something we spoke of earlier about Plato. Mm-hmm. Did you want to ask that?
Plato's comment, I will see if I can remember it accurately, was that he did not trust trees and rivers. They held no worth for him. Where he found his truth was in men. Guess it was Robert Graves' comment was that Plato was no poet, nor did he respect the poets.
Well, Plato went further than that. He, when he wrote The Republic and described what he believed to be the ideal society, he said very explicitly the poets would have to be banned from it.
They were romantics. They didn't understand logic. Is that the reason he thought they should be excluded?
Yeah, I think that's the simple answer. I think this is an extremely complex, and it could get abstruse very quickly, issue. But I think the first thing is that it needs to be treated with irony. Graves knew that Plato started out as a poet, as a young man. And if you look at the Greek anthology, there are some very passionate lyrics by Plato, written before he became a philosopher. And Plato also offered the first definition of poetry as inspired madness, and all of the romantic notions of poetry were defined originally by Plato. Given the nature of Plato's Republic, which is a rather rigid place, I think that Plato maybe was doing poets a great service in leaving them out of the Republic. That, in fact, the Republic of Plato was a place the poets would never want to live. Plato, in fact, is the great philosopher of poets, and there's a great Platonic tradition in poetry, which is the main tradition in Western poetry. So Plato's relationship to poetry is, again, that would be several university courses. One of the great Platonic poets was Shelley, who's famous for his calling poets the unacknowledged legislators of the world. It's easy to interpret that as saying they deserve more acknowledgement. But in fact, I think what he was saying is they must remain unacknowledged legislators of the world.
In exile, outside.
Exactly, and that's where they gain their power. Mm-hmm. Milos has written a book subtitled Modes of Eccentric Vision, and by eccentric he means what the word meant originally in Latin, outside the center. Poets, even if they live in New York, have to feel outside the center. Mm-hmm. And they generally start out as the little kids in school who always feel they're not part of any clique.
Sure.
They're outside, they're observing.
In the southwest of the United States, Joy Harjo says that in some ways she became a poet because she was a half-breed, mm-hmm. not accepted by white society, not accepted by her Indian society. And so she became the one with eyes and ears, the one who could see, and now she sees herself as a bridge.
Well, if poets were once seers, they were gifted with what was called second sight, mm-hmm. and that implies a sort of double vision that you don't get from feeling at home where you are.
Right.
And another value of poetry, actually F. Scott Fitzgerald said this about all literature, that if it's really great, it manages to say two things at the same time, two things which often contradict each other. Poetry is a way of speaking with a forked tongue. It's a way of saying two things at once, and that's why you can't just explain a poem and understand it. You can't mm-hmm. find out what it means and understand it. If you did, you wouldn't need the poem. You could throw the poem away.
Once again, Nora Dauenauer's oratory made the room feel. I mean, I may be in error here, but I sensed that a room full of people found that place, were moved, and I don't know whether we could have sat and explained it afterwards, but she took us to grieving and through it
mm-hmm.
when she invoked the dead to come and help the grieving recover.
And that wonderful sense of being able to see things without in any way being morbid about it, from the perspective of the dead and the perspective of the living all at once, uh-huh. that's double vision. That's uh-huh. double talk in the best sense.
Not explainable, but understandable.
And, yes, right. It reaches the heart
mm-hmm.
directly. So poets have to be outside society in that sense. They have to feel that they are, whether they actually live in the wilderness in Alaska or, you know, in Midtown Manhattan. They are outside society. They are eccentric.
Do we then in this country, since this series of thoughts started with the relationship between the American public and the American poet, do we then in this society treat our poets well as resident exiles? Inasmuch as the society both ignores and nurtures its poets?
No, we don't treat them well, but except in a way that I do think we need to have programs that provide material support for many poets. This is why the Academy exists originally. But I would qualify that by saying that in some sense, poets are never treated well by society, even in Russia, where you have this popular response. You also have had in the past brutal treatment of poets. And I think the poets should be honored, but they should never expect to be honored. Once they do, they cease to become poets.
Maybe they lose that vision with all the eyes looking at them.
Well, it's tricky ground. I mean, I think poets, you know, every poet should be a millionaire. But and should be an acknowledged legislator. But I say that with tongue in cheek, and I do mean it when I say that Plato was maybe doing his poets a service when he left them out of the Republic and put them off in that place where there were trees to learn from.
You are a poet yourself. For those who may have, again, tuned in late or have lost track a little bit in the last 40 minutes or so, this is Bill Wadsworth. He is the executive director of the Academy of American Poets and has been since 1989. He has been and is still the advisory editor of the Paris Review, a panelist in literature for the New York State Council on the Arts, and was, before taking this position with the Academy of American Poets, the director of the Writers in Performance series for the Manhattan Theater Club. In other incarnations, he has been the owner and manager of a wine shop in Vermont. But, as I started to say, he is, among other things, a poet. I was very taken with a poem called Saturn, and I wondered if you would be pleased to read it for us and then to talk about it some. I have it here, which is convenient. Or you?
Sure.
Good. Bill Wadsworth reading from his poem, Saturn.
I'm going to say before I read this poem, the essential story of Saturn is a very simple one. He was the predecessor of Jupiter, or Zeus, among the Greek gods, and he was known to the Greeks as Kronos. He was the god of time. And in the original Greek myth, he ate his children. Zeus was the one child who escaped this fate and then overthrew his father, time.
He ate his children because he was warned that one of his children would overtake his position as God King. And so he decided that to keep himself safe, he would simply make a meal of each of them, right?
That's the story. The underlying interpretation of this is that time is something which consumes its own children. It gives birth to everything and then destroys everything. What brought this to mind after I wrote this poem and I was searching for a title was an absolutely terrifying painting that I saw once, which you or some of your listeners may know. It's a very famous painting by Goya of Saturn, and it hangs in the Prado in Madrid, and it's a painting of an absolute monster madman ripping a corpse in half with his teeth. It's a very bloody, terrible thing. With that in mind,
right.
I will read this poem.
Good.
Saturn. It was our favorite game. My sisters and I escorted him to the usual place at the foot of the stairs. His slicked back hair gleaming black, he grinned down at us, pulled off his jacket and tie. Big neck, big chest, ex-tackle for the Big Ten. He closed his eyes as he lay on the floor and sprawled on his back. He passed into a solemn hibernation. My pulse raced. Anne sat on his legs and grabbed his ankles, her strong arms rigid as she pinned his feet. Nancy knelt on his left arm. I remember her blonde bangs and battered shins, who with gap-toothed fury whispered, "He's sleeping, quick." I dug my knees deep into his bicep, pressed my hands in the thick fur of his wrist. I stared at my hands. Then his chest moved with a groan. His white shirt rose and fell. I smelled my father's body, the complexity of his sweat. The hand flexed. We cried out when suddenly the whole frame shifted. We tried to escape, but he pulled us all into the air with a growl and swayed as he stood, kissing the combined bodies of his three children. And we were convinced in our ecstasy that our father was eating us, and we believed he would not put us down. And the hand, the arm, the hairy wrist, the smell of sweat, the gleaming head, are more real than my own body now. My sisters kneel on the floors of their houses. They are searching for his arms and legs. I know what happens next. I stare at my hands.
Saturn by Bill Bott Wadsworth. Time takes him away. Time makes you that huge and powerful person from the little boy with the little hand, and time will take you away. It's so sweet and so sad all at the same time. Tell me what this poem says to you. Is it first autobiographical?
Yes, it's autobiographical. And I'll tell you one thing that's interesting to me is that I wrote this poem, I think it was 3 years ago. And, of course, I've revised it continually since. But the main problem in revising it was always that I couldn't find a title for it. And I found the title Saturn about 2 weeks ago.
Is that right?
And the poem had another title. I won't even tell you what it was. And which says something maybe about the creative process, which is a mysterious thing, and I don't really understand it. But I do have a sense that the way that writing works is that you write and write and write and write and write. And what that is sort of knocking on the muse's door. Mm-hmm. And you knock and you knock and you knock. And if you lose faith in yourself or in the muse, you quit knocking and you walk away. And you, I suppose, could knock an entire lifetime and the door would never open. But I think that everyone by their own lights feels if they keep at it long enough, at some point, the door opens.
And it may be an unanticipated door. It may be the one behind you at which you're not knocking. It seems to me mm-hmm. that the act of knocking somewhere...
It's the act of knocking.
The act of work hauls forth the muse.
And when it happens right, it's like you didn't have to... You certainly didn't have to bang the door down. It's just a light tap. And the door just swings open, and what you wanted is right there. And you have it for a moment, and the door shuts, and you may have to knock for another few years. But... I was dissatisfied with this title, and for that reason, I've never submitted this poem for publication in 3 years. And I guess I'm ready now, because mentally I kept knocking, and I don't know, it was just the memory of that painting came to me at one point. I wasn't even thinking about this poem, and I thought, well,
that's it.
The title of that painting is the title of this poem.
Right.
And it is a poem about time. I wrote it as really there was an immediate need to write about something that had happened a very long time ago. That for me was a primal scene. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that it was about time per se. It was really for me about my father's death.
Mm-hmm. You have made him very, very big, and your sisters and you very, very small, which to me is part of the art of poetry. In some ways you've done that by disembodying him, but you look to his neck, his hairy arms, and you've made him in that way Gulliver in Lilliput. He is this immensity with these little people holding on to him, which speaks to me again of the vulnerability of the child and the strength of the father, the strength of the parent.
And in that moment, we were in ecstasy. We mm-hmm. loved that sense of his power as much as we were terrified by it.
Mm-hmm.
The terror was the pleasure.
Bill Wadsworth, what next in your life? Is the Academy of American Poetry, American Poets, a place you will stay? Are there other things itching for you?
Well, I think that's a hard question to answer. It's certainly... place I would like to stay right now, because I can't think of anything that could interest me more to do for a living than this. I guess I was about 15 when I decided that poetry was the thing for me. And I had other interests. I was interested in music. Actually, what I was good at that time was physics. I really thought I was going to be a scientist until I was 15. But I read T.S. Eliot and Wallace Stevens, and I thought, this says more than any equation possibly could. All of physics is contained in this and everything else. I didn't say it at 15 that way, but that's how it hit me. It just overwhelmed me. And so to have the opportunity, I'm very early on, even though I've been writing poetry for 25 years, I'm very early on in my work as a poet. And of course, I'm always looking for time and the opportunity to write. But when it comes to the other part of life, making a living, and to the other question of poetry, which I think should be a question for all poets, which is, where does your own work fit in? I'm in my mind, it's very clear that poetry, language, matters far more than anything I could add to it, even if I wrote a great poem. So to have the opportunity to, in some very concrete way, serve a language, serve poetry, serve poets, is tremendously satisfying and fulfilling and exciting to me. So I would love to keep doing this.
Thank you for an hour on Conversations. It's been most enjoyable. Bill Wadsworth,
thank
once
you,
again,
Susan.
The Executive Director of the Academy of American Poets, here with us on Conversations. Thank you for joining us today. I hope you'll tune us in again next week.
It was, first of all, there was no reassurance that it would be edited at all. It was really a completely unedited broadcast, which made me nervous. But I just, the questions threw me, because the person asking them, though he was a nice person, I don't think really asked the right questions, or gave me the room to speak, just to have the room to digress was terrific. And the questions, I mean, your way of doing this is made it very easy.
Good. I hold high the value of time to digress. You talk about poetry in some ways, in the way I, if you don't mind a little already sloshed water, in the way I view a program like this, we don't in this society take much time, have much time, but even when we have it, we don't often take it to sit down and think about a thought for an hour. And thinking about a thought for an hour is a pretty alien concept in America in 1990. I mean, after all, at the very least, there are grocery lists and places to go and people to see and appointments, and if that's all not there, then there are TV shows and movies and 14 magazines you subscribe to, but none of which you have time to read. So it's one of the reasons I like and do this program, is to sit down and to let 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 people also sit down, most of whom actually are in their cars or in their gardens or washing the windows or sweeping the floor in reality when we're doing this, but to let the audience sit down and consider a thought or two for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Feels to me to be an important thing. Small, but an important thing to do.
Do you know what the word consider means originally?
Mm-mm.
To look at the stars.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. It actually means to look at the stars long enough that you can see the constellations.
Uh-huh.
It means to bring the stars together.
Con from constellation or from some root?
No,
of
con
that?
Means bringing things together.
Constellation, to bring things together.
Sidur, what's the word for star? Anyway, we get the term sidereal time from the same root.
Sidereal time. What does that mean?
Star time.
Star time.
I'd have to go to the encyclopedia to give you a better definition than that.
But that means long time, then. Star time is in eons, right?
Well, no, I don't think it has to do with that so much as it's a way of measuring time as opposed to solar time, which is what we do normally. You know, years, uh-huh. days. It has more to do with the movement of the stars, but I couldn't. Huh. I couldn't. I may already be becoming inaccurate. Mm-hmm. But what is the...
That's funny, though, because we think of a stargazer as someone who's a little dreamy.
Well, yeah, and we also don't think of Alaska as a real place.
Yeah, well, that's true.
And we think of poetry as a dilettante-ish.
Yeah. So we're weird. But we knew that.
Yeah.
Right.
Frost said that the only thing the poets really needed to learn in school was astronomy. He also said that what most people call thinking is voting.
Ha, sure. Would you mind if I keep that?
No, I'm very flattered that you like it.
I think you still own it unless you handed it back.
Oh, I took your copy.
Yeah, I do. I have a corkboard in the kitchen that has a...
Well...
People and things go up and down on it as I have, so I can have time to look at them.
It's funny. If no, you want my honest opinion, it's the... it's not as good as most of the other poems. I forget what I sent you, but I think it's pretty good. It's the poem that always works best in readings. Mm-hmm. But...
Is that because it is so evocative? It is. If I can see everyone on the floor scrabbling.
Yeah.
See Gulliver hauling them up.
And it's a dramatic poem. Everything it needs to say is represented in the action that it describes. Mm-hmm.
It is also like Nora's oratory, evocative of the feelings.
And it's an unliterary poem. It doesn't depend upon much else than the story it tells. And it's very clear. You can read it out loud once, and it has its impact.
That's a good radio poem, then, huh?
But it's funny. I mean, it's funny how... You're one of the first people who's read it on the page and responded to it that way.
Rather than
hearing
you
it.
You read it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And,
So it works.
I guess that's why you're on radio, huh?
Because I have an ear for an eye.
Exactly.
Yeah, I guess I do. They're pretty well joined in my life. Well, I hope
an
you
ear for an eye, a tongue for a tooth?
No, it wouldn't be a tongue for a tooth.
What would it be?
An ear for an eye and a tongue for a... Oh, I don't know. I'll have to ponder that one. Definitely, an ear for an eye is what works for radio.
An ear for an eye, a toe for a tooth?
A toe for a tooth. Well, I hope you will send it in for publication.
Well, actually, I will be.
Like it.
Very shortly.
Now that it has its hat.
And if it gets published, I'll send it to you in published form.
Good. I'd like that. Do you want a copy of yourself? Do you want a tape of this?
I would love a tape, yeah.